Welcome to Free Speech Bites. I'm Kirsty Hughes, Chief Executive at Index on Censorship. Free Speech Bites is our podcast series made in association with SAGE. In this series, Nigel Warburton interviews a number of leading figures about free expression and why it matters.
Timothy Garton-Ash is a historian and political commentator. I spoke to him about the online free speech project he's running at Oxford University. Timothy Garton-Ash, welcome to Free Speech Bites.
Great to be with you.
The topic we're going to focus on is global free speech. Now, we've talked a lot about free speech on this series, but why global free speech?
Because 86 people out of 100 in today's world have a mobile phone. 3 to 4 billion are on the internet. And therefore, the old classic way of thinking about free speech, which is what should be the laws in our country or the rules of the game in our country, no longer applies to the same degree, because information and ideas are flowing across frontiers much more, and people are flowing across frontiers much more, as Article 19 envisaged them doing.
And yet, there are restrictions on freedom of the internet in different countries. So China's very good at shutting down freedom of speech where it needs to or wants to, and other countries around the world have found ways of censoring in alignment with their own particular laws.
That is exactly right. And therefore, one of the great battles of our time is the battle of, so to speak, the internet versus China. Because the cyber utopians who made the internet, the American cyber libertarians, this weird mixture of the Pentagon and the sort of libertarian anarchists and rock musicians, John Perry Barlow, who declares the independence of cyberspace, the internet will set you free. And to that, the Chinese Communist Party says, hang on a minute, oh no, it won't. And it is not clear who will win that battle. But what is clear is that you have to be an enormously powerful, determined, authoritarian state with a great firewall around you and throw enormous resources at the business of censorship and blocking to keep control of the internet.
So are you arguing that there should be a completely unfettered internet, or do you think that it's appropriate that there are limits on what can be expressed there?
Free speech is not unlimited speech. It is not global logorrhea. This is clear. What I am arguing is that it does not suffice to have a purely national conversation about what should be the limits to free speech, but what we need, and what our whole project here at Oxford, freespeechdebate.com, which is a website for debating what should be the global norms, what should be the rules of the game, debating them, by the way, in 13 languages, is about, is saying what are the areas where there could genuinely be global values. For example, paedophile child pornography. That is an almost universal taboo. Almost all states and private actors in this field proactively block, filter, and attempt to combat child pornography. So there are actually already global norms. On the other hand, if you look at political speech or so-called hate speech, there are clearly huge differences. So let's talk about it.
To take that example of hate speech, it's a very delicate issue because one person's hate speech might be another person's political dissent. The notion of hate speech has been used to put down all kinds of people who oppose authorities, whether they be political or religious. Now, say somebody says, look, I want to contribute to your debate. I think that we ought to draw the line at the point where somebody utters hate speech. That doesn't decide anything.
First of all, who is we? And what does drawing of the line mean? And one of the things I want to say most strongly is that the right to offend does not mean a duty to offend. And there's a vast territory between what the law should ban. In my view, the law should ban incitement to violence. The law should ban dangerous speech. And what is dangerous speech will vary from place to place and context to context, as we all know. It depends on your media landscape. It depends on the society, the culture, the circumstances. That does not mean that hate speech should be acceptable editorially or socially or culturally. And so I'm trying to place the emphasis much more on social and cultural and editorial norms rather than on this really old and boring and sterile debate between American First Amendment fundamentalists and European hate speech banners.
So what is the mechanism here? Are you looking to create international law that is very precise about where the limits of freedom of speech lie?
No, I think the international human rights framework, given essentially by the interpretation of Article 19 of the International Covenant and Article 10 of the European Convention, is very important. But I'm looking to go beyond that and to develop a debate, almost a Habermasian debate, about global norms, which must then be implemented on multiple platforms. And the point here is that at the end of the day, what Facebook does is much more important than what France does. And what we do as netizens, as online users, may be as important as what the police do. I don't for a moment believe this is going to be neat and tidy, because a joined-up world, an interconnected world, is not a neat and tidy world. It's a messy world. It's like a big city like London. But in a city like London, people have worked out, by and large, how to live together. 300 languages are spoken, people from every culture in the world, and yet they rub along more or less together. And we should be able to do that on the online world too.
Well, to take the contrast between a largely secular country like Britain and a very religious country like Pakistan. Now, on the issue of blasphemy, you're going to have completely opposing views about where free speech becomes a kind of hate speech, I suppose, that blasphemy is sometimes characterised as, because for a Muslim, certain sorts of utterances are not negotiable. They cannot be accepted under any circumstances, whereas in Britain, there's a much more tolerant society. People can mock, ridicule certain sorts of ways of being, up to the point of religious hatred, as it happens. But some people would argue that even that's too much of a limit on freedom of speech. So how do you get a middle way between those completely contrasting ways of approaching the issue of blasphemy?
Clearly, how we talk about religion is one of the big differences in our world. Actually, it's not a big problem with China, interestingly enough, because they're not big on monotheistic religion, but across the Islamic world, it's a huge issue. One thing this exercise does of laying out what might be a draft set of global principles is to see where there is agreement and where there really is not. Because, of course, all the media coverage always necessarily concentrates on disagreement. If it bleeds, it leads. And so we all know about blasphemy and about fatwas and about all of that. Let's look at many areas where there is a fair amount of agreement. Protection of privacy, for example, reputation, some other areas where there's considerable agreement. Let's identify the areas of disagreement, and then we can take a number of positions. We can say this is simply an absolute global universal value to which there should be no exceptions. That is my position on incitement to violence. I don't think violence in response to speech, in the broadest sense, to freedom of expression, is justifiable anywhere in any circumstances. And of course, by violence, I don't understand legitimate coercion by a democratic state. Okay? So I think that's a universal absolute. Now, when it comes to how we speak about religion, we have a draft principle on freespeechdebate.com. It says, we respect the believer, but not necessarily the content of the belief. Classic liberal principle. The difference between the recognition and respect that I owe you as an individual human being, whatever nonsense you believe, and appraisal respect, which looks at the nonsense you believe. And there's a wonderful line, which is, I respect you far too much to respect your ridiculous beliefs. Right. Now, I believe that should be a universal norm. I believe that everyone everywhere would be better off. I present our 10 draft principles to a group of Indian MPs going right across the board, and they all jump up and say, we can accept most of what you say, but this one is totally unacceptable. It simply would not work. It's India. In India, that doesn't work, they say. The way we work as a multi-religious, multicultural society, to the extent we do, is by respecting the other taboos. And then you face the question, what do you then do about that? This is, after all, the world's largest democracy. It's not a dictatorship in which a politburo of a few people are dictating the terms to more than a billion people. My answer to that, I think, is I will continue to argue passionately for this liberal universal norm. I'm just going to India next month to do exactly that. But I would not say that this should be a universal absolute in the same way that the ban on violence in response to speech must be a universal absolute, and we must demand of Pakistan and of Saudi Arabia, as we do of Germany or Britain, that they respect that.
That's really interesting. It sounds as if your 10 principles are emerging in ranked form now. That, so the way they originally appear may not reflect that, and perhaps the research will lead to an ordering of those.
This is exactly where we are at the moment, and it's very interesting because the way this has emerged has been, forgive the jargon word, dialogical. It has actually been for a year and a half of debate. I presented this stuff in China, in Egypt, in the United States. We've done a series of events, and gradually it emerges what are these fundamentals on which there can be no compromise. And it also emerges where these really big differences are. So, yes, I think that's exactly right.
I can see that China is a challenge, but there are also challenges closer to home. I mean, for instance, a small country, Belarus, is not very pro-freedom of expression. Now, while there is a dictatorship, it seems unlikely that a dialogue will lead to a change of heart on the treatment of free expression within that country.
You know, my formative experiences were in Eastern Europe in the 1970s and 1980s. And we used to hear diplomats and politicians in the West saying, Poland will not accept this, or Czechoslovakia will not accept this. And it's a classic confusion between the regime and the people. I would say the Belarusian people, at least in large measure, know the value of free speech almost better than we do. And so you don't need to wait until there is the full freedom of speech in the given country to start that debate. And by the way, this is true of China too. We've had the most fantastic response from China, from the microbloggers on Sina Weibo, from Chinese students, from people when I was there. Hugely exciting debate about free speech. They too have their limits, but they're certainly not the limits set by the Chinese Communist Party.
Is there a risk that if a liberal sets up a website that discusses freedom of expression, it is bait for liberals to debate the fine discriminations that they might make amongst themselves, but the people who are the real tyrants are elsewhere?
Indeed, there is that risk. And there is also the risk that it will somehow be seen, because it comes out of Oxford and seems to be a Western liberal project, as part of a larger complex of Western liberal imperialism. I am very, very clear about this. We cannot have a debate about what should be global free speech norms in which we simply open a blank page and say, scribble on it, like graffiti on a wall, because you would get nowhere. There has to be a structure to that debate. And the best way to have that structure is what philosophers would call normative universalism. That is to say, we lay out what we think should be the best way to do things for everyone, everywhere, but are then genuinely open to the debate. And that's the spirit in which I engage in this whole project.
So it's a kind of reflective equilibrium where you start with a position, go back to the world, and then perhaps adjust your position in the light of feedback.
Correct, but it's not a treaty-making operation. That is to say, it's not attempting to do what Hans Küng claims to do, which is to extract a sort of quintessence of all religions and say this is a global ethic, nor is it attempting to come up with a deal like an international treaty. As Habermas argues, what happens in such a conversation is that you put in question, in the spirit of the Enlightenment, by the way, your own treasured beliefs. You criticize them from all angles, as John Stuart Mill says in On Liberty. That's the whole point of free speech about free speech. But at the end of the day, you decide what you believe, and then you must stand for those values.
I'm intrigued by how you filter the influx of content that's coming to your website. How do you decide which contributions are worth listening to?
We have contributors from, in fact, subscribers from over 80 countries in multiple languages. I have a team of mainly graduate students at Oxford who are native speakers of all these 13 languages. I listen to them. And sometimes they will say, this seems to us an important issue for our country, even if it doesn't seem to be so for the West. So that, in short, I think there is, so to speak, the Scylla and Charybdis. The Scylla is global First Amendment American messianism, which basically says a bunch of white men between about 1600 and 1800 worked the whole thing out, or maybe 1919 or 1960. We worked it all out, you guys. Here's the deal. It's what I call the IKEA version of free speech. Just buy the pack and assemble it at home. The opposite extreme is a sort of woolly, ecumenical, lowest common multiple sort of blancmange, which will get none of us anywhere. And what we have to do, I think, is to steer a course between that Scylla and that Charybdis.
I think some listeners would see your account of the First Amendment as a kind of caricature, because the First Amendment, as it is enacted now, is the result of negotiated cases and jurisprudence. It's not as if a law was written and then implemented in a straightforward way. And actually, for significant parts of American history, there were laws which curbed freedom of expression in the political area.
But that's precisely the point, that when you look at it, what contemporary Americans call the First Amendment tradition starts in about 1919. And some of its classic cases, New York Times versus Sullivan, Brandenburg versus Ohio, from the 1960s, is incredibly recent. But in the American mythology, the founders, the founding fathers in the Enlightenment, came down from the mountain like Moses with these thoughts fully formed. So the very history of the First Amendment shows that these things do evolve as societies and cultures evolve. I'm a huge fan of the First Amendment. I really am. I think it's great in most respects. But I do think that if you're looking to move the conversation forward in an increasingly post-Western world, coming at it with that classic American liberal, slightly messianic, universalist rhetoric is not the best way to open up the conversation, because an awful lot of the world just clams up when they hear that coming in an American accent.
And when the research has reached a certain level, are you going to pull these threads together into a report?
In terms of the website, what we want to do is to turn it into what I hope will be a rather special online resource. And our idea is to pick out the best. Okay, you say, well, who decides what's the best? Well, that's an editorial judgment. The most interesting, the most stimulating content, and thread it together in a kind of guided tour. And the guided tour will be different in Urdu and Arabic and Turkish and German and Chinese and Russian, because, as I said, the Chinese, with a few exceptions, don't care much about monotheistic religions. One sometimes has the impression that the Islamic world cares about little else. So clearly the critical issues are different from place to place. And in truly classic Millian fashion, John Stuart Mill fashion to try to open up the conversation across cultures, not between cultures, because to talk about a conversation between cultures involves the fallacy that there are monolithic cultures and that there are people who are somehow empowered, like the American president, to speak for Islam or to speak for Confucianism, whereas, of course, cultural purity is an oxymoron. They're all mixed up together. But there is certainly a need for a conversation across cultures.
This is obviously a project which takes a lot of energy and time. What motivated you to start this project?
That's a very good question. I actually started looking at the challenge of combining freedom and diversity in Europe. And of course, in Western Europe, that means mainly, quote-unquote, Muslims. Although you immediately actually have to take that apart and say, where do they come from, what's culture and what's religion and what's other factors. But that's where I began. And looking at that, you'd look at education, you'd look at the labour market, you'd look at religion, you'd look at immigration policy. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff. And I think that's all very important. But the more I looked at it, the more I thought to myself, what do I really care passionately about here? What do I actually feel I have something to say about? And what is the key to the whole thing? Because I think it's as true of the challenge of combining freedom and diversity as of so many other challenges, that freedom of speech is the freedom that makes the other freedoms possible. And if we can get this one right, if we can agree how we disagree, if we can agree how we talk about difference, then a lot of the other things will follow. Having got into it, I then, of course, very quickly realized that the internet had changed the whole landscape. And so, in a sense, there's a double challenge here. One is the challenge of diversity that you see on the streets of a city like London or Toronto or indeed Kuala Lumpur. The other is the diversity that is living together online.
Timothy Garton-Ash, thank you very much.
Real pleasure.
For more information about Index on Censorship, go to www.indexoncensorship.org.